I prepared a relatively formal talk, which shouldn't take too long. I'll try and just get through it. And then what I want is for you guys to ask questions, take me back, take you back. And this is your talk, not mine. So I thought I'd start out with a story, and then I'm going to ask you a little bit about you. Then I'm going to do the talk and show you the slides that I prepared. And then we'll be recursive and go back and pick out whatever is interesting and talk more about that, if we have any time. And Steve and I will be in the exhibit hall, so you don't have to ask all your questions now, because we're not going to disappear. The story that I wanted to tell is about the first West Coast Computer Fair, at which I gave the first talk on microcomputers in education. And I expected that I'd have a bunch of hobbyists, because that's all there were. So I prepared a talk called Sharing Your Computer Hobby with the Kids. And I, not being a hobbyist, struggled to try and get people who were like you guys look, and to try and talk about how to go and talk to 10-year-olds and teachers who had never seen and never wanted to see a computer. The talk was at 8:00 in the morning, and when I got there, you could look out the window and see this huge crowd of people waiting to register and get into the West Coast Computer Fair. And there were about 14 people in the audience who had gotten in by 8 or 8:30. And so I asked them who they were, and they said they were all teachers. They didn't know anything about computers. They were not hobbyists, and I didn't have a talk for them. So we may end up that way again, in which case, just take over. So my first question is about who you guys are. I know this guy in the black shirt is my husband, Steve Smith. And he declined to talk. He said, nah. But my guess is that half your questions you're going to want to ask him, not me. So that's OK. He's the non-speaker. And it's OK if he speaks. The rest of you, are you teachers? Are you a teacher? Are there any teachers in the room? Ha! It's 25 years later.
Now you're prepared.
Well, but now I know, now I really know that I'm not a hobbyist, and I really know that I don't know anything about computers. For me, they're tools. How many people here were there when the Apple I came out? How many people were using were there mentally, there and awake and aware that it was coming out? So you guys are going to keep me honest. If I say something that doesn't seem to be accurate, interrupt me, change it, tell us your side of the story, because I think that what we're doing here kind of is laying down history. We lived it, some of us, and then there's another generation or another two generations who are rediscovering it. And it would be nice if we got it right, or at least got multiple versions of what happened at the time. So I'm counting on you guys to help me out. Can everybody hear? Okay. If I start fading, just yell, scream, wave your arms, and tell me to be louder. So we have a number of people who are also experts, who've been here, who've been there, and who've seen it. How many people in the room have never written a computer program? Okay. You can be a microcomputer enthusiast these days and have never written a program. That's a new thing. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Anything else? Any other characteristics of you guys? How many people are collectors but not really, don't know anything about electronics and don't really want to know anything about electronics? Got one. Anybody else? Okay. I'm an educator who doesn't really want to know anything about electronics, So I'm in the same court with you in a sense. But most of you have, I don't know if this is working or not, most of you have an interest in electronics and old electronics. Is that right? Okay. So now I have some sense of what the slides that I prepared are sort of okay. And if I bore you, kind of nod and close your eyes, and I'll keep an eye on the audience and try to pick up on that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about computing history, and this is going to be computing history from my perspective, not the truth. So I want you all to add in and correct, and we'll create truth. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the work that I've done, which is education. I'm a social philosopher, not a computer hobbyist, and I got excited about computing. If this is off, we could move it away. I got excited about computing because I was interested in it as a social phenomenon and a change in the way we live our lives. And I'm also interested in education for that reason. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about my work and why we taught computing the way we did. I'll talk as much about the Apple I and the Apple II as you want me to. Now, the truth is, I'm a complete ignoramus. I don't even own those machines. They were given to Loop Center, which is my nonprofit corporation, which I started in 75 to do this work. So they belong to the public, but I'll protect them. And then I want to end the formal part of the talk with a little bit about what I see going on in the future for computers and education. And I'll probably put in a lot of digs at what's going on in the present. So if I take too long with stuff, kind of go, hurry up, Liza. Let's see, it's 11:10. I'm going to go through the slides in about 20 minutes. Every once in a while I look at my watch, or somebody can clear their throats very loudly, get me to go. This is Liza Loop's eye view of the history of computing. And I just want to admit that I grew up in a family that was involved in computing in the 40s. I was born in 1945. And at the end of the 40s, my father, who wasn't in the household by then, but whom I knew and listened to, was working with Jerome Wiesner at Lincoln Labs at MIT. And they had built a computer called Ollie's Folly. Now, I don't know anything about this, but I think it kind of got into my early subconscious.
It looks like it.
And then I know a couple of years later, in the 50s, my brother, who's 5 years older than I am, was considered a genius. And he was given this kit computer called a GENIAC. And again, I was, you know, playing with my dolls and teddy bears while he was putting together that. And I think that also influenced me. So that's my view of computers in the 40s and 50s. In the 60s, in 63, I went to college and fell madly in love with a physics student who was doing analyzing radio astronomy data at Cornell. And I ended up doing key punching for him for Fortran 4. So I knew there were computers. I knew they were housed in a huge building. And that all you ever saw of them was this stack of cards, which God would strike you dead if you dropped. So computers were IBM cards, 180 columns. So that was sort of 63, 64, 65, I was at Cornell. In the middle of that time, I got a summer job at a hospital, which is now Boston and Women's Hospital. They've combined all the hospitals in Boston these days. And they had a big Burroughs computer, which ran COBOL. Now, I was a nurse's aide, and the biggest computing problem that affected me, aside from the fact that I needed to get my paycheck, was that we did the nurses' schedules by hand. And I knew there was this computer downstairs somewhere in the bowels of the hospital, and it seemed to me that if we had a computer, we ought to be able to optimize the nurse's schedule. Now, little did I know that that was way beyond 1964's COBOL's ability. But again, it was another inoculation. Charles Prime. Okay, come the 70s. As I said, this is my version of computing history. Come the 70s, I was a non-student in Berkeley and had roommates who worked. Yeah, we did call ourselves non-students. Had roommates who were working in the computer industry. Eventually went to Sonoma State and eventually met a guy whose name was Dean Brown, who was at SRI at the time. And they were using computers, teletypes, and time-sharing to Lawrence Hall of Science to work with Montessori schools. And I took a course in, introductory course in Montessori education. And Dean walked into like the third week lecture, the lecture on the third week. And he's the kind of person where he walks into a room and the room tips toward him. And he talked about this neat using Pilot and having the kids, the Montessori students, five, six, seven, eight-year-olds, program their Montessori lessons in Pilot on the teletype for the other kids to use. And I said, that's where I'm going. That's my career. I don't need to hear anymore. This is what I'm going to be doing. I knew I wanted to be in education. And probably all that early contamination of computers is I knew that there was something going on here. So that was, let's see, my first son was 6 months old, less than that. He was born in September. I took the course in starting in January of 72. So I stayed in touch with Dean and said, among other things, I got to see a mouse at SRI in like 72 and Game of Life. So here's some more contamination. Learned Pilot, taught myself a little basic, and decided that I was either going to have another kid, move to Europe, or start a computer center. And I had another kid. I did go to Europe, and I started a computer center. So I'll talk a little bit more about the 70s. In the 80s, you guys were all here in the 80s. So we know a lot about microcomputer development in the 80s, movement of computers into schools. And what I like to say is that when I started in 75, when I started Loop Center, people would say, you want to take a computer into a classroom, whatever for? And by the end of the 80s, teachers were saying, I can't teach. I don't have one computer for each student. So there was a major change that happened during that time. But now, we've got another major change, which is the internet. And I think that we are still facing... We're still facing exactly the same problems that we were facing in the 70s about using computers in education. So that's where I want a new learning revolution in 2000. So basically, that's all I'm going to talk about. History. Ready? There are a number of different pieces of history. And these slides are out of order. Oh, well. Computing history changed from data processing. It started as data processing in many senses. We processed data in the 40s with paper tape, with paper, with typewriters, with secretaries, and we began to use punch cards, and not necessarily IBM cards, but there were many card sorting devices with punched cards before we ever had computers to sort them, and you stuck a rod through them, and I actually tried to use one of those systems once. So that was data processing in the 40s. Computers were real fancy advanced things that crazy people like my father liked to play with. But nobody really thought they were going to do too much practical. In the 50s, they became practical. We counted people, we counted the census, did lots of calculations. They were room-sized machines, and that history is well documented. In the 60s, we really started to use computers for accounting. And handling lists, doing mailing lists. Again, we're still looking at mainframes, we're still looking at cards, although there's a little bit of interactive computing. Let's see, in 67, when I went to Sonoma State, there were still some people who were submitting their card decks, but we had a room full of teletypes, and Cal State, which was California State College is then, not Cal State University, had a central computing center, and we could do interactive computing on teletypes. So we had ARPANET, DARPANET, which some of us rogues would go and find a tip somewhere and beg, borrow, or steal a log on and send messages back and forth. So. And then there were some other systems. Actually, Planet and the Institute of the Future systems and the RAND systems started in the 70s. They weren't in the 60s. But the ARPANET was at least an inkling of what we would have as the internet. And there were a lot of us who were thinking about what the possibilities of this kind of technology were. And we're still thinking about it. In the 70s, which is kind of where a lot of us are focused today, we got the microcomputers. We opened Loop Center with a teletype to call computing in Palo Alto, a teletype timeshare account to Lawrence Hall of Science, and we had an IMLAC, Intelligent Terminal, which had a 4004 in it, and that was our computing power. And it was unheard of that anybody would put computers in a little office and say, John Q. Public, come and play, which is what we did. So we were the second public access computer center. People's Computer Company in Menlo Park was the first. It's the age of people's computing in the 70s. Now, not very many people got into it, but that was the start. People started talking about the paperless office in the 70s. In the 80s, we discovered that we were wrong. Computers became very, very popular, ubiquitous, and created more paper, not less. And you still had to have your manual systems because the computers went down constantly and they didn't talk to each other. So has everybody here heard of SneakerNet?
Yes.
That was what we used. If anybody hasn't heard of SneakerNet, it's when you take the disk out of one computer and run it over to the other computer and put it in with your sneakers on. In the 90s, we've gotten to the point where it's no longer cool to be computer illiterate. Everybody is thought to need to have, at least be able to use an automated teller machine. And by the way, when we started in 75, there were automated teller machines, and that was one of the things that we talked about with the kids we were working with, about a use for computers. So there's data processing. I'm going to bring data processing and some other aspects of computing together, because ultimately I'm seeing the computer as the controller of a robot. So, yes? Together we can get it. And so in the work that I've been doing, we always worked with robots. We always worked with even the keyboard and the screen as a concept of a robot. So that the computer is the controller, but what the people interface with are the I/O devices. So it doesn't matter whether the I/O device is a Mars rover, or a big track, or a keyboard and screen, or a web TV. The computer itself is of interest to a set of hobbyists and a set of computer scientists. But for the public, it's the robot aspect. It's what you can do, what this machine does in the world, and how you affect it that's the focus. So I keep going back to robotics and machine control as a way of working with computing concepts and getting people involved with computing concepts to tantalize their intellect and get them to think about problem solving and how to not create problems. We can do that without even thinking about it. How to see a problem, how to structure a problem, how to solve it. And ultimately, that's what I'm interested in, is problem solving and learning to deal with whatever your environment creates for you. So keyboards and screens were I/O devices. We had lots of other neat things. We had turtles. Has everybody heard of turtles? I'm seeing a couple of people not nodding. A turtle is an I/O device that was developed at MIT by Seymour Papert in his lab. And it was a little machine that usually ran on a wire from your computer, and you could program in Logo. Seymour put a pen on it so that you could draw things. You could have the turtle draw things. And it was a neat device for kids to get involved. And actually, everything that was a neat device for kids to get involved with was a much neater device for adults to get involved with. There were turtles and turtle geometry, which was a way of working with educational computing. That went on to a whole area of Logo and micro worlds, which I didn't really get into. That was a little bit later in the mid 80s. Let's see, who came out with the big track?
Milton Bradley
came out. Has anybody seen a big track? No.
No.
You didn't bring it, did you?
We are not teachers.
Next year we'll bring the big track. Big track is a little robot that Milton, the robotic toy that Milton Bradley built, has a flat panel keyboard on the top of it, and it's programmable in something that's very, very much like the Logo language. It was very popular for a while, but schools and teaching organizations didn't pick it up. I mean, here's the first portable, really portable computer that you can do something with. So we use that at Loop Center to teach programming and, again, concepts, machine control concepts. And there's all kinds of other I/O devices that one could hook up, and hobbyists do, but really haven't gotten into education. Education is still keyboard and screen, largely, which I think is a travesty. The limits of memory, storage, and computational speed we have been running into since microcomputers started. We're not running into it so much these days, and what we're ending up doing, which again I don't like much, is we're using up a lot of our speed and a lot of our storage ability in fancy graphics, which is fun, is exciting. I couldn't have made the slides without it, but on the other hand, it steals some of the power of the computers that we have, and it steals some of our attention from some of the more interesting things we could do as machine controllers, and it distracts us from the problem-solving aspects. The problems we're solving is what color should, you know, is this the right color, rather than how do we structure a larger problem
to figure out how to solve it. We've also spawned a whole new field called animation, and that's actually what my son has gone into. My kids, growing up with me as an avid computers and education person, would have nothing to do with them. From their births in the 71 and 73 until about 90, let's see, this is 99.
I mean, John started in 92.
Beginning to dabble with computers. He's now an animator and starting his own company. So early inoculation, even if it doesn't look like it's going to work, may, and my older boy is also using machines as tools. And animations and graphics is kind of the next, one of the next industries that's coming out, or is here already. Let's go back to the 70s. That was a quick trip to today. Public access computing, which is, again, as a social philosopher, where I'm really at. I'm looking at my watch and I'm looking at this pile of slides and saying, 20 minutes, huh? Nobody's closed their eyes and nodded off in the back yet, though, that I've noticed. These four organizations are the four places where in the world, as far as I know, and again, we can correct history as we remember it, you could get your hands on a computer in the 70s. I'm not sure what year Boston Children's Museum opened. They had a PDP-8, and then they went to an 11. So they had a timeshare machine, and you could go in and sign up for computer time and use that, but you had to pay your... You could play the games that they had available. Yeah.
Who's the Lawrence Hall of Science? Because we did this in 72 at Lawrence Hall of Science.
Oh my God, I did this last night.
Lawrence
Hall of Science.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually, I think, the first place you could have access to.
Yeah, the Exploratorium might have had some stuff.
No, the Exploratorium wasn't running.
The Exploratorium came on later.
It's later. So let's put Lawrence Hall.
Yeah, 1972.
Community memory.
Community memory was a little bit later. Lawrence Hall was before community memory. Good.
WISA, and they also had the stock market game.
Yeah, ELIZA was the first computer program that I ever played with at MIT in the 60s, in the early 60s. Four. So, as I said, this is not real history. Thank you. That's what we need, is to complete the history with all of our memories. And as I said, I had a terminal from Lawrence Hall of Science. That's what we opened up with. An educational organization could buy computer time from Lawrence Hall, timesharing time. Of course, you had to also buy an account from Timeshare and also fight with AT&T about whether they could charge you extra because you were sending data over the lines. And the only thing you could use was a teletype, but it was neat anyway. And I brought downstairs a lot of the materials that we were using at this time. There was no way to fit them all into a talk. Oregon Museum of Science and Industry also had one of the first, they had both historical exhibits and some hands-on exhibits. People's Computer Company in Menlo Park on Minolta was, as far as I know, the first public access computer center, which was not in a museum. It was there as a computer center, and that was all. And then Loop Center was the second, and I thought of it independently and was immediately sent to Bob Albrecht, who ran People's Computer Company, and Bob and I have become friends. And I stole as many ideas and procedures from People's Computer Company as I could. And I now have the PDP-8 that they used to run on. But I didn't bring it today because the 4K memory expansion weighs 200 pounds. then there were others. I think Loop Center's biggest claim to fame, aside from having the original Apple I, was that we were also probably the first storefront to have both computers and a copy machine. So Kinko's owes me. So let's talk a little bit about Loop Center. As I said, anytime you want to come back and correct these slides and we can really make it more complete and better, the better. This was the kind of thing we did at Loop Center. Birthday parties, field trips, personal computer time, classes. I didn't know anything about computers.
Note that the address and telephone number that are up there are for Lou Walker.
Right.
Yes, that's right. There are cards that have the correct. And we no longer have a storefront, so you can't come and do what we could do in the 70s. But that's partly because most people have their own computers now. This was on what?
Not PDP-8s, though.
This is true. So what I did was I decided I was going to open this computer center. I got the two accounts, one from Qual Computer, one from Lawrence Hall of Science, and rented a teletype and opened for business, except that I didn't know what I was doing. I'd played at Lawrence Hall of Science. I knew the pilot software from the Montessori course. So we could run that stuff. We could run the games. We could run the Huntington Project. And I've got Huntington Project, which is early, early educational software, which ran on minis and eventually was ported to micros. I've got books from that. Huntington Project was science education, and you'd be amazed at how rudimentary it is. And I couldn't, I knew that I didn't know enough to do what I was trying to do. So I decided I really needed some computer hobbyists. And so I started the Sonoma County Computer Club as a project of Loop Center in order to get someone who would teach me what I wanted, what I needed to know to do this at all. So, and we had the first or second meeting of the Sonoma County Computer Club, and somebody said, you know, there's this other place down in Palo Alto called Homebrew. You ought to go there. So I went there, and during part of the sharing part, I stood up and said, I'm starting a public access computer center. Now, Waz was there. I said, I'm going to take computers into schools. Waz was there at the time. I don't know if it was that meeting or the meeting before that he was writing the basic compiler in the hall outside while the speaker was speaking. But he heard me, and some of our other computer club members went to him and said, hey, you know, if you're really going to make a computer, let's do this thing. And that's the result. He gave us the Apple I. He brought it to a Sonoma County Computer Club and said, here, naked board. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
She must have learned that from the 10 o'clock.
So we started without a microcomputer. But we started in unofficially in December of 74, and January of 75 is a landmark date in computing because?
Altair.
The Altair was first announced in popular mechanics?
Popular electronics.
Okay, one of our computer club members ordered it the first day. He got it. He put it together over the weekend, and we had one at the end of January in Loop Center. Unfortunately, there wasn't much we could do with it. He figured out it wasn't anything he wanted to do with it. Which is why he brought it to us. So we used to play diddle with the lights on the front. We could do calculations with our computers. And then, of course, we had 101 basic games. And I have, if anybody's got a PDP 11 or an Edge system, I have paper tapes with 101 basic games on them, which we used to load in through the teletype. But about the most important thing you could do was teach programming. And the talk, the buzz at that time was, are we teaching about computers, or are we trying to do teaching machines and teach with computers? And that controversy, 25 years later, is still going on, and it's still a really important one. Since you guys are not teachers, it seems to me that a lot of what you're interested in is about computers, using computers, how they work. I don't think you're as interested in teaching machines. And one of the things, I'll risk the conclusion is, I think that teaching machines are wonderful and terrible. But that's what's going on in schools today, is computers are largely being used as teaching machines. And I think it's terrible.
Is it teaching machines or mind control?
You want to distinguish between the two?
I will, but we're here.
I'm trying to get through this so we can get to the fun stuff. Okay, so we started out, we had an Inside, we had a Cromenco, we had an Altair, we had one of everything that were lent to us. We put them in the Public Access Computer Center. The hobbyists played with them. The kids didn't. The kids played with, and the educational stuff that went on for little kids was the basic games and the educational software we were getting out of Lawrence Hall of Science, and it was available on any time-sharing machine that ran BASIC. I did get ahead of myself. I already said Homebrew Computer Club is where the Apple came from. Waz always wanted this machine to be an educational machine. The reason he gave it to me was because I was, this is what he said, is that I'm the first person he ever talked to who said he was going to take it into classrooms, which I did. Unfortunately, the Apple I wouldn't stay up for more than about 15 minutes. So you got a 40-minute math class, right? And I'm going to try and teach. The first school that it went into was Windsor Junior High School, because I found a high school math teacher who was interested and would let me take it into the classroom. And we take it in that box with that keyboard, try to get it running, and we had a cassette player, try to get it running, and usually the whole 40 minutes was me saying, well, this would have been a really neat calculator. So my computer club people were very enthusiastic, and I said, but I can't use it. And so I decided to buy, at that point, Digital Equipment Corporation, or as we finally called it, DEC, was advertising the classroom computer, the ultimate classroom computer. Now, this was a PDP-8E installed in a desk, a big, heavy metal desk. So I ordered one of them. And Digital Equipment Corporation had never sold a computer to an individual before. I think it cost $6,000, and they would not write me a purchase order until I had the $6,000 in an escrow account in the bank, because they could not believe that an individual wanted to buy a computer. So that's a whole nother story.
What year?
76 or 77. And then, of course, it was supposed to be a classroom computer. It was called a Classic. And if it got dust on it, it stopped working. He said, you show me a classroom that doesn't have any dust in it. Of course, we weren't in a classroom. We were in a storefront on Old Redwood Highway in Cotati. And that's cow country. It was dusty. Anyway, so... this line, it says, itinerant computer teacher was the way Woz described me in Wired this last year. And the story, if I'd had more time, I would have gotten you the URL for where that is on the net. It's in Wired and it's relatively recent. And apparently, Jeff Raskin decided to sell his Apple Ones on eBay. And he claimed that they were the first Apple Ones, and somebody checked. And Woz said, no, that's the first Apple One. So my claims are secondhand. I've already told you a little bit about how we used it. You've seen it. I didn't know whether I was going to be able to show it, so I took pictures of it. Had to get the digital camera from my son. But the problem was that this is the way it came. And I didn't know what to do with it. That's the back. So the guy that bailed me out was one of our computer club members named Glenn Wurstel, and I tried to get in touch with Glenn last week, can't find him. I saw him about 3 or 4 years ago. He's around. But he was working at HP in Santa Rosa at the time. So just as the original parts for the Apple were part of HP's giving parts to their people to hope they do something creative. Do you all know that story? Oh, that Woz was actually working for HP when he... Here, I don't have any slides on that. Woz was working for HP when he conceived of the Apple, and HP was encouraging people to take parts and build stuff. And the only constraint was that HP had to have first dibs on whatever they built. So Woz built an Apple prototype, Apple One, and took it to his supervisor, who said, nobody's interested. They had first dibs on it. So he made some more. HP didn't want it. He was free to market it and form Apple Computer Company. So when he gave me this one, and it came naked, and he said, oh, well, by the way, the manual that came with it, that little green thing, is all that I got. So I came to a Sonoma County Computer Club meeting and said, help. And they, Glenn said, oh, sure, I'll make a box in the power supply. And actually, Steve dismantled the old power supply because we were using the Apple II in the same box. And he needed a different power supply. But that's what happened. And so the power supply was also made from parts from HP entirely independently. So let's see, I was in this classroom, the Apple One was crashing all the time. I was embarrassed as hell because I was really trying to do this really pioneering thing. We're going to get computers in the classroom. We're going to introduce children to computers. And it didn't work. So my club member said, don't worry, he's going to give you another one. Don't worry. He's making another one. Just wait. It'll get here. 3 or 4 months of embarrassment later, he showed up with the Apple II, which we just unscrewed the Apple One, took it out of the board, plugged the Apple II in, and that's what's there.
Well, and a whole new power supply.
I think it ran on the old power supply. Well, we're inventing history here. But this one still works. And worked, and we put a teletype on it, loaded paper tape first, and played basic games with it. And started doing some programming in BASIC. There were people who came into the storefront who actually knew assembler and would program it in other things, mysterious things with three-letter acronyms. Is it three or four?
Three.
I never got that far. So, so there it is,
history. Subsequently, we got the deck machine, which was much easier to use. We never did get Apple IIs. Now, one of the reasons we didn't get Apple IIs was because I knew Waz, and I knew he couldn't build a computer that would work. It's also why I didn't invest in Apple Computer Company. So, so Loop Center functioned for about 3 years as a storefront computer center. By that time, I had proved that I was not a business person and that I couldn't make any money at this. And I had too much fun playing with the kids. And so we closed the storefront. And I got a job at Atari because I'd been writing the course material for the things that we did at Loop Center. And so what I knew how to do was write instructions. And some of our computer club members got jobs at Atari, and then they came to me and said, Liza, you're the only person who knows about these weird people called users, and we need you at Atari. So I wrote the user's manual for Atari. And Steve was the person that actually wire-wrapped the first prototype Atari computer, and that's sort of the end of my hardware tale, because after we got Apple IIs commercially in boxes, I also went to work for Radio Shack because schools at that time wouldn't buy anything at retail. You had to get an educational discount, and Radio Shack, when the TRS, the Model 1 came out, wouldn't give the teachers a discount. And so the schools wouldn't buy computers. So I got a job as a Radio Shack salesperson, which gave me a 10% discount. So I could go, and I could go and buy Model 1s. I did spend some time on the store floor, but I don't think I ever sold anything. What I would do is buy Model 1s myself and resell them to the schools at my cost. So we got 5 or 6 computers into schools in Sonoma County that way. We got a couple into libraries, and then pretty soon the PET came out. So it took off after that. I got more involved in the philosophy than the actual practice, because other people were now, the fight had been fought and won. Didn't have to do that anymore. So I was involved in the philosophy beforehand. But my interest now is much more in how can we break the lockstep of what schools have become and education has become. I always saw the computer as a Trojan horse, as a way to turn kids on, turn people on who didn't want to just follow and let the teacher be a funnel for information. A teacher-centered classroom works for some people, but it doesn't work for everybody. So when we played games with Loop Center, when we played games in the early computer play shops, we always played the game by hand with a paper and pencil or just your memory or a blackboard. Then if there was a game like Battleship, we would get the plastic board that you paid somebody $10 for at that time. It's probably now $50. So that you had the plastic pegs and you had a commercialized version. And then we would play it on the computer. And sometimes the computer would serve as a game board, and sometimes the computer would serve as an opponent.